before we start going further, and we'll do a little bit of review on last week's topic, which was changes in halakha based on changes first in physical realia, whether it be in the natural world, whether it be in the human world of technology. We're going to focus more on the second side a little bit at the beginning of the shiur, which is halakha responding to change in the human world, meaning social changes that occur across the years of history. As we mentioned several things, we mentioned the Miri in terms of changes in how non-Jews behave. We mentioned the Sri De'esh in terms of mixed groups. We're going to speak a little bit more about both of these, actually, even though we're going to focus more on the social side of things. And then I want to spend the second part of the class speaking about Rav Lichtenstein's article. Before I go further, I just want to mention there's a couple more sources. People who are interested in reading up more about Shinui HaTeva, changes in the natural world, two very nice resources you should know about. Yehuda sent me an article which I was not aware of by Gil Student. Gil Student is a fellow in New York who runs a very interesting blog spot called Hirhurim, which has a lot of fascinating discussions in it. In any case, he has a whole discussion which is good in the sense that it's short enough and very clearly written, so it can give you a nice English overview of the topic, as opposed to the article which it actually appears in English also that I gave you 2 weeks ago that we discussed from Professor Steinberg of Shari Tzedek. People who want to go further still into the topic should look at Yehuda Levy's book called Science in Torah, I think, Science in Torah, if I'm not mistaken. He has two, one's called Torah and Science, the other one's Science in Torah, so it's hard to remember which is which. But in any case, he's the former rector of Machon Lev, he's a very interesting thinker in his own right, a little bit conservative for my taste, or perhaps the presentation is more conservative than my own temperament, but it's still an interesting guide on this subject, touching on almost all the major sources, including all the ones that we covered and many more. We mentioned last week in passing, last 2 weeks really, that though many halachot do change because the situation no longer seems to apply, there are other situations wherein the situation has changed, and yet the halakha does not respond to that change. In other words, if we look at halakha as it is now, there are certain things we keep, even though the reason doesn't seem to apply. I mentioned a kitniyot as an example of something which is actually post-rabbinic, where the reason may not apply. We discussed Rav Moshe's tshuva about onah during the first 3 months of pregnancy, as well as that of nursing, where certainly most poskim do not follow Rav Moshe's approach, even though the reality seems to have changed and women do not seem to menstruate in the same ways during these periods as the Gemara records and is brought down in the halakha. And even Rav Moshe, though he says that we should follow the change in reality, he doesn't go with that all the way and says it's only an issue b'diavad, b'lechatchila, concerning checking and the like. We should follow the halakha as it appears, grounded in the realia of the Gemara, which doesn't seem to be the case today. A more interesting example, interesting because it's very developed in the halakhic literature, is the issue of treifa, which again, there are many sources. Anybody who wants to look at it should look at those two sources that I just mentioned. But it's a klal, which is not really a klal, but it's rabbinically understood to be authoritative, that a treifa, an animal with a defect that renders it unfit for kosher consumption, should not live out the year, right? As if it has one of the simanei treifa, one of the signs that make it, one of the illnesses that qualified as a treifa, it should not live for 12 months. And the halachic ramification of that is, if we're in doubt, if the animal has that sign or doesn't have that sign, we watch to see if it lives 12 months, and if it lives longer than 12 months, so we figure out that doubt based on that. Again, I'm probably going too fast for some people. It's not that important if you don't get all the details of this, but the problem arises when we observe animals that seem to have the siman that the Gemara speaks about. It clearly has the defect that the Gemara speaks about, and it lives out for 15 months, 18 months, 2 years. What do you do about that? So there's a whole development to this, but essentially we say we don't care, right? The halacha is brought down in its clearest form, both in Digrot Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and the Chazon Ish, both saying the same thing, that it's true that we see that animals with these problems, with these maladies, live for longer than 12 months in many cases, though not perhaps not in most cases, but in many cases. Nonetheless, the halacha is that if it has that sign, even if it lives longer, it's still considered treifa. So therefore, in this situation, the halacha does not follow the reality. And Rav Moshe and and the Chazon Ish both say that the halacha was set at that time. There's again, I don't want to get into the details of this particular halacha too much, but just for the record, one of the reasons that it works that way and may not be the best example of halacha that should change but doesn't is because the Gemara in passing speaks about it as halacha l'moshe m'sinai. Doesn't mean that everybody agrees to that in the Gemara, but the Rambam formulates it as such, which gives it added strength, and therefore this may be an exception to the rule may not be the best example for that reason. In any case, the point being, whether you follow the discussion, the treifa and the ona'ot or not, the point that I'm trying to make is that the halacha does not always follow changes that we see in the observable reality around us, even if it's physical realities, as these cases are. What I want to discuss a little bit is some of the factors that push poskim towards accepting change in halacha in certain situations as opposed to other. And we mentioned very briefly last week a couple of things. Based on some of the sources that we saw, what do you think some of the considerations that were pushing poskim in the direction of incorporating change in reality into a revision of halacha? Right, what sort of variables seem to come out of you? You can remember some of the different issues that we spoke about. We spoke about eight-month-old babies. We spoke about Halav Yisrael. We spoke about halachot of Jews and non-Jews of Hashavat Aveda. What sort of criteria? We spoke about Kfiat Amita, right? Whether we turn a bed over or not. What sort of variables did you see in those? Again, I mentioned in passing, so maybe someone, yeah.
It seems like there needs to be a redeeming value of change, some sort of mitigating reason that we actually lose something if we keep it the way it is.
Good. Okay, excellent. So there's point number one is a need. There has to be a need. If there's no real, nothing gained on the practical level, so poskim are less likely. In other words, there's a cost. Poskim view a cost in changing halacha. Even in the most obvious scenario, there's a certain courage that's required for a posek to say the halacha is different. Even in the most obvious case, so we took the example of kidneyot, which seems to be fairly. Again, I haven't studied the case very well, but let's assume it's a clear cut case where the reality is such that it seems that it no longer applies. So there has to be a need, there has to be a benefit. There's certainly a cost. As from the world of psak, of tradition, changing something, even if legitimate, comes at a cost. Okay, so there has to be a benefit in order for us to make a cost-benefit analysis. So that's issue number one. What other issues might... Yeah?
Whether it will further the halachic agenda, or perhaps
so that's also part of the larger rubric of need or gain. Well, what else? What other variables?
Intrinsic value.
Okay. Okay. So we'll get more to that later. Any other issues? Yeah.
But I think one of the things that generally is in terms of need could be a societal push towards changing. Need, I think, we developed from a game of seeing, well, we're going to society down to the internet, but it also be just a push towards change.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from just the need to change it, I think it also has to be a push to change it. It has to be a desire to change it. From, not necessarily the person themselves, but from the people.
Okay. Right. Again, the list of needs can be very large. You know, some of the things that come up are danger to life and limb, right? Economic considerations, historical issues, meaning religious, historical, post-Kim are trying to push the Jewish community in a positive direction as opposed to a negative direction. But what other variables? I mean, besides need, what other variables will push a post-sec towards change as opposed to refraining from change, right? In the halachic world, what other halachic variables might encourage a posek to take the plunge? Yeah.
Isn't there just an respect for halacha? And when something becomes antiquated or clearly is not appropriate or beneficial anymore, it makes people look at halacha in a jaundiced kind of way.
Again, I think everybody's looking at it from macrocosmic. We're all looking at need in all sorts of different ways. But again, I'm asking people to look into the halachic system itself and look at the microcosmic issues. In other words, granted, obviously all these things are very important and very real, but don't forget that the halachist needs tools. He has to go into his bag of tools and find something to work with. So there are other things that validate a position besides the fact that it doesn't make sense. What else might validate a posek in making the change as opposed to not making the change? Okay, minority positions. And as precedent, I'm going to expand that. Precedent is really what I'm looking for, but I'm looking for precedent in a different type of situation than what you're... Because essentially when you speak about a minority opinion, you're speaking about an academic precedent. Academic precedents are something you go to in the second tier, but you have to get there first. There has to be a reason to go to the academic precedent. But there's another type of precedent which is clearly much more influential in halacha, and we saw it in a couple of places. We saw it with Kriyat Amita. We saw it with Chalav Yisrael. We saw it with the Aruch HaShulchan's defense of using petroleum lights, reading by petroleum lights on Shabbat. What am I referring to? What type of precedent?
Society,
meaning, what's the word for it?
Minhag.
It's called minhag. Minhag, okay? In other words, if people are noheg, are ready to act in such a way that seems to disagree with halakha, a posek is more motivated to say, you know, they're right. I'm going to look at the halakha and see how they're right. By the way, there's Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, writes a lot about this issue and feels very grounded in the approach of the Tosafot in Europe as opposed to the Sfaradim. So the Sfaradim, the Rambam and the Rif and the like, are not very convinced by Minhag. In other words, for them, if they see the Spanish Jews doing something that disagrees with the Halakha, they're going to say that the Spanish Jews are wrong, right? Generally speaking, you know, that's interesting, by Hanukkah lights, there's a whole discussion that as far as the Rambam is concerned, the Sfaradim are completely doing it wrong, but he goes along with it anyways. But in general, that's unusual for the, at least according to Chaim Soloveitchik, but I think it's well established, this position, that the early Ashkenazic tradition is very much more influenced by tradition, so much so that he goes to the extent, and again, I think it's well established, that for the Tosafot, if there's a minhag, it's equivalent to it has equivalent strength as the Gemara. In other words, if the Gemara says one thing, and they see the minhag in Ashkenaz as contradicting the Gemara, they treat it as if they're two different statements in the Gemara contradicting each other. Right? In other words, much of the analysis of Gemara is the two statements that seem to disagree. So you have to come up with a conclusion that satisfies both of these statements. In Tosafist approach to halakha, it's not just two Gemaras that have to be reconciled, but also practice minhag together with sex. Okay, so if a minhag already exists, like fiat amita, when people, Tosfot saw, people are not turning the beds over anymore. The Gemara says, turn over your bed. Must be that there's been a change. In other words, that's what motivates them to ratify the change halachically. Same thing with Rav Moshe. One of the things he says, people are drinking this milk. By the way, the idea behind that, it's important to understand what's grounding that. I mean, it sounds like, on some level, it sounds like a chutzpah. What do you mean, minhag? So what? But the assumption of the Baalei Tosfot, and part of it is because the pious community that they lived in northern France, and again, you can read, Avram Grossman speaks a lot about this in several books on that time period, among others. Their assumption is that if religious people are doing, serious religious people are doing it, some serious rabbis must have instructed them to do so earlier on. How did they legitimate it? We don't know, but therefore we have to go back and see, and with our own minds, how to recreate the logic that allowed for such a minhag. Okay, so minhag, besides on a more meta halachic level, this is simply the concept of being dan l'chav zchut. Right? If Jews are doing something, one poskim, you see this a lot in the Aruch HaShulchan, you see many poskim, we're trying to, for ethical reasons, try to justify their behavior, if it can be justified, on a larger level as well. Yeah.
Would there be then a substantial difference between a Tosafist society where most people are shomrei mitzvot, or I guess you could say frugally conscious, as opposed to a society of amei haaretz where most are not conscious,
right,
of halacha?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but let me try, and then if I get it wrong, you'll ask it again. Though I understood the question, it's a good question, if that's what you asked or not, is you know, how's the post-it going to respond to a from society, meaning an educated society, as opposed to a society of people who are less knowledgeable? So the Rav Herschel Schachter, the Rosh Kollel at Yeshiva University, used to say that if there's something called Minhag America, then it's wrong. And as he was specifically expressing that idea that the religious culture in the United States was not sufficiently educated to say that if they're doing something, it must have grounding. Right. I was going to make that point also. Yeah. Oh, someone mentioned that in many circles in the United States, many Orthodox circles, snake dancing was practiced in the 40s and 50s. And many other things, as Gila said, you know, the Lashon Hara wasn't kept. Also, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's acceptable me not. Did I get the question right? Okay. I want to go on a little further because we have a lot to cover, and I set a goal to end 10 minutes early. Because we need to take our group picture, so if I set that goal, maybe we'll finish 5 minutes early, and we'll have time to do it. In any case, unless it's a clarification question, anybody want a clarification?
I just have to mention a little bit, that I just wonder if for some politicians that you're on the track to reform Jewish.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll discuss that. We'll get to that later when we get to Gideon Rothstein's attack on Professor Sperber and the others. Okay. In any case, so that's variable number two. Variable number three, and there may be others, but the three primary variables that are going to encourage Poskim towards change. Number one, we said, is a need, and many types of need that we discussed and can still discuss. Second variable is defense of pre-existing minhag. Third variable is they're much more easily going to do something lahachmir than lahakel. Right? Lahachmir, they're going to be willing to say, for example, the famous issue of kinim, killing kinim on Shabbat, right? Killing lice on Shabbat. So the Gemara, I mean, it's a discussion. It's not clear exactly why it's permitted. But within the discussion, there's the possibility that it's permissible because they generate spontaneously. Obviously, scientifically, that's certainly not the case today. Whether it was ever the case is extremely doubtful. Although, again, Professor Levy has a whole discussion of certain types of lice. There's a whole large discussion, and perhaps it can be explained. But be that as it may, it's not really our point right now. The point is that to say that you should not, you know, the halacha is that you are allowed to kill lice on Shabbat. It's much easier for a posek to come along and say, because it could be that our lice are different, or whatever explanation he wants to give, we today should not be killing lice. As opposed to the person saying that, the case of the 8-month-old baby, right, or the meal after three, the washing the baby after 3 days, where the posek, in this case, they do take the plunge for obvious reasons, but it's easier for them to tell us not to do something that the Torah allows, or that the rabbis allow, than to tell us that we can do something that was prohibited. Okay? Because when you're abstaining from permissible practice, you're not really going against the Torah. You're simply being machmir. You're setting up an extra fence for yourself. So there are also, rabbis are more willing to be adventurous in halacha, or daring to make a change. Now, there's a question I asked you to consider, and perhaps because of a short amount of time, we'll go straight to the application. But I want to remind you, the question I asked you, why is it that when it comes to social realia, right, that society has changed, that poskim are more conservative, and it is more controversial to invoke social change as a legitimate criteria in the change of halakha, right? So let's go straight to the applications. I don't know how many of you, I made it optional because the articles were very long, at least most of them, the articles on women's aliyot. And we're going to focus first on that issue of social change, and then we're going to speak about some of the larger issues that came out of the discussion. By the way, I'm not really interested one way or the other in terms of the issue per se. It's not, and bring it as an example for the general issue of change in halakha. In any case, just to give you the historical progression of the articles, the emails came in unhistorical way, so I don't know if you first saw the wrong order. Very short little article from Rabbi Rothstein brings up some of the most important points, so if that's all you read, it's also okay. But in any case, the first article was that, it's a very long piece, I think it's 50 pages, something like that, by Rabbi Mendel Shapira, which was sort of a landmark piece, writing in defense, or in favor, I should say, not really in defense, but more in favor of allowing for women to have aliyot in certain situations. Rav Mendel Shapiro, I know very little about. Apparently he lives in Jerusalem, he's a lawyer. His articles, from my perspective, was very, very well argued, certainly thoroughly argued, certainly with many, many sources and at length. In any case, his was the first salvo of on this discussion. He was responded to, I think the discussion took place in 2002, 2003, I don't recall exactly. In any case, he was responded to by Rav Yehuda Henkin, who I feel bad, he's more known by his relatives than by himself, by who he's married to, by who his grandfather was. But in any case, he's an important posek in of himself, on his own right, rather, in his own right. Has written several books and articles and the like. In any case, he writes a very interesting article on some level strengthening Rabbi Shapiro's article, and at the very end saying that even though Rav Shapiro is not only right, but he's even more right than he thinks he is, as far as the maskana, as far as the halachic application, he argues on technical issues, but as far as the technical, as far as the halakhic conclusion, says that he's completely right. Nonetheless, women should not have aliyot because it goes against the fabric of Orthodox society. So this, in turn, got Dr. Daniel Sperber, who usually comes to teach in our Beit Midrash for technical reasons. We probably won't have time to have him this year. He's a wonderful Talmid Chacham and truly wonderful man as well. Got incensed and wrote pages on pages in response pretty much to that statement that we shouldn't change the halakha because it's not what's done. I mean, paraphrasing. In any case, that was the third part of this discussion. And then all of these articles, by the way, came out in the Eida Journal, which is now the Meorot Journal, because no longer Eidas, it's only Meorot's put out under the auspices of Yeshiva Chov Torah in New York. In any case, in response to the articles that came out, another friend of ours of the Cardozo Academy is a personal friend as well, Rabbi Gidon Rothstein of Riverdale, Five Towns, wrote a response attacking all the articles that came out in favor of women's aliyot. It's interesting because Rabbi Rothstein is a very open-minded fellow, but he attacks them in a very strong fashion, as we'll discuss. So in any case, that's the history. Sorry?
Where's that article published?
It's in tradition. I don't have the exact year. Again, probably 2005. The part the article that I gave you from Rabbi Rothstein is not the article that was published in tradition. It was part of what he submitted. It's the part that didn't get published. So the part that did get published was his attack on Rav Shapiro. The part that did not get published, which is what you saw via email, is the attack on Rabbi Sperber. Okay, so that's the history of the polemic, the discussion, at least the main part. Yehuda tells me there's other articles still, but as far as I know, these are at least in the English language press and journals, the main part of the discussion. But in any case, to our point, the main impediment to women's aliyot is what's called kavod atzibur. In other words, that's the sources. The sources exist already in the Gemara, right? The Braita, the Sefta, right? And that's what's discussed in the Rishonim, what's brought down by the Poskim. There's a problem. It's an affront to kavod atzibur. Now, the major discussion is, what does kavod atzibur mean? That's a major discussion, the pre-modern, or really up till the contemporary discussion. This discussion is, what is kavod atzibur? Does it apply in all circumstances? Can it be waived? The contemporary application is whether it still applies or not. That's very interesting. Again, as I mentioned, Rabbi Henkin strengthens the argument by taking it out of the area of controversy. That's what Rabbi Henkin does. And he makes it a very, parva is the right word. In a sense, it's more powerful. And halacha, if it's more parva, is more powerful. If it's controversial, it's less powerful. Rabbi Henkin simply reiterates one of the directions that Rabbi Mendel Shapiro goes in and says, it's really the discussion. Everything else is really sort of an afterthought. But essentially, the direction that he goes in is that the Gemara was speaking about coveted Sibor as something that would be an embarrassment. And it's called Tibor, the way the Ritva understands it, and at least according to Rabbi Henkin, is the way it is to be understood, is that it was embarrassing to men to have women read if they themselves did not know how to read. In other words, if women are being called to the Torah, it would be an indication that the men present didn't know how to read and that they were less educated than the women present, given the onus on men to be learning Torah, so that's more of an indictment on them than it would be to women, their status as being unlettered. In any case, that is no longer applicable for two reasons, right? What would those reasons be? Again, on the non-controversial level. Anybody do the homework? Yeah.
Because nowadays, men and women are not, men are not better readers than women in terms of Hebrew reading.
Sorry.
They may know how to lay better because they were taught it, but there's no supposed education gap between men and women in this regard.
Okay, so that might be, I mean, you can say that in a even less controversial way, even though you're right, but the I'm saying, you can say in such a way that's purely halachic.
Women don't read from the Torah altogether.
It's not that women don't read, it's that no one reads. No, yeah, that's right. That today when we're talking about aliyot, we're not talking about reading anymore. Okay, so that's point number one. But I was going to get to something else in terms of your point. So the first point, again, to reiterate, is that in the time of the Gemara, as you have in Yemenite shuls and among some Sfaradim, the person who was called up would read. And so if the woman came up to read, so then it would embarrass the man who was not able to read. But if
they're both.
Is that? But if the
man, the whole community actually, isn't it?
Sorry?
The shame is not just for the men, the shame is on the community, that the community haven't been able to produce.
Okay, fine. Yeah, holy up, not sure. But it doesn't really.
Okay.
Yeah, in any case, it's not really that important. It's not really that important for.
Sorry, but that was covered.
No, but you say it. Okay, again, it's a technical point as far as this discussion is concerned. The other issue, which I thought Benjamin was alluding to, is that there's really no functional literacy. So having a woman going up doesn't say that men are illiterate because there's no functional literacy. Again, maybe laning is something different, in which case everyone would be illiterate. But in any case, there are technical reasons that have very little to do with any sort of controversy that can be brought to bear for women to have aliyot. Now, Rabbi Sperber and Rav Shapiro before him didn't just go in that direction. I think Rav Shapiro tried to cover every possible angle, and sometimes more is less. When you try to cover every possible angle, you get yourself into more trouble than if you just keep it safe. In any case, he brings up another conception of Kavod HaTzibur, that which of the Bach. The Bach is the Beit Chadash. It was one of the major commentaries on the tour, who says that it's really not an issue of embarrassing men who are literate, but rather it's an issue of Kvod Shemayim. It's an issue of not picking the best or the most honorable possible representative to represent you in front of God. In the same way that if you're choosing someone to represent you in front of the king, in front of the prime minister, whatever it is, you would pick the most honorable member of the Sibur. To put women in front of men is a denigration of Shemayim. Okay, that's what the box says. Okay, and again, to cover that base, I'll quote you from Rabbi Sperber, even though, again, Rabbi Shapiro says much the same thing. He says it's entirely possible that the congregation has waived its dignity, or that it senses no affront at all to its dignity in women being granted aliyot. For when all is said and done, women in Israel, or the United States, or whatever it is, can hold the office of state controller, justice of the high court, education minister, or even prime minister. He's giving these specific examples for those who know something about Israeli politics. All of these offices have been held by women. And we, he says, sense no affront when we go to court and a woman sits as judge. It may be, therefore, that the concept simply does not apply to the contemporary congregation. Okay, so here, what he's doing, he's using the type of tool chest that we were speaking about before, saying, society has changed. That could be the Bach was right. This Kavod HaTzibur has to do with sending the most honorable representative. And if we find that a woman is more honorable as a representative for us than men are embarrassed, or the congregation is embarrassed. And if you go back to the discussion of Dvorah in the Bible, the prophetess Dvorah, there's no men around. Right? And it's an embarrassment, she says to Barak in no uncertain terms. You know, this is what people, it's going to be an embarrassment. Right? That I have to go with you, that means that there's no men capable of leading the Jewish people. In those terms, right, the Bach is saying, that's a problem. Comes along Rabbi Sperber and comes along Rabbi Mendel Shapiro, and they say, that was then and this is now. Back then people were embarrassed by sending women as their representatives. Today no one's embarrassed of having a woman preside as a judge or a prime minister or the like. The question I have, though it's certainly politically incorrect, is that really true? Is that a clear fact? In other words, is that something you can ascertain and say that society, in fact, accepts women the same way as men for any office without any sense of embarrassment? And maybe it's the Sephardi in me that has reservations about this, but again, politically correct or not, I'm not so sure that we can be so clear about changes in attitudes. Or, relating to the previous class, when the Lavush says that, it's not just the Lavush, many of the Midachronim speak about mixed company being less problematic, Kevin the Dashba, because people are accustomed to it, so therefore they're not, there's no sexual arousal that exists because people are used to it. Is that so clear? Is that something you can measure in the same way as you can measure government supervision of milk? Right? Is it something that you can measure in the same way as you can measure whether 8-month old babies can live? There you get into the problem of social realia. Okay? And therefore, anybody who brings in that concept certainly has ground to stand on. We saw that the Rishonim spoke about it. We saw that the Tosfot spoke about the lack of Kavanah, right, which is a social phenomenon. Nonetheless, there's more of an onus of proof because it's much more difficult to prove and to evaluate. And there is the greatest level of controversy in this particular issue of women's halacha. Women's aliyot.
Am I wrong that I saw that Rabbi Sperber was also bringing up the question about kavod ha-tzipur versus kavod ha-adam?
Yeah, that's correct.
It's basically saying that kavod ha-adam is more important than kavod.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
Ari Frimmer and Bill Frimmer are the ones arguing.
I forgot to bring Ari Frimmer as also part of the discussion, but in any case,
kavod ha-adam, to me, he was speaking about the woman.
Again, I'm focusing on what in both of the articles, both in Rabbi Sperber and Rav Mendel Shapiro, they both present a lot of arguments.
Right.
It's true that the central argument of Rabbi Sperber is Kavod HaBriyot trumping Kavod HaTzibur. But in getting to there, he has to discuss and analyze what is Kavod HaTzibur. And one of the things he does in the process is, and I'm pointing out this because it fits in more in our discussion, and to point out the controversy of that on a meta-halachic level as opposed to the discussion of kavod abriyot outweighing kavod atzibur, which ultimately can be related back to a simple halachic discussion. But in his discussion getting to there, in discussing kavod atzibur, so he makes the claims that, first of all, Kavod HaTzibur might be something that we can be mochel on. And secondly, he says that the Gemara's discussion of Kavod HaTzibur, and this is the main point for our discussion, is the Kavod HaTzibur that still applies today. Okay, so and then the thing is, even if you say it applies, then I have Kavod HaBriyot. Okay? But moving on further, again, we could discuss this at much greater length, but the topic per se is not important for the course as much as some of the issues that are brought by the discussion after that. So this is sort of saying goodbye now to realia as items that are brought in to help in the change and the revision of halakha, and moving on to other more meta halakhic issues. There's a lot of discussion, polemical discussion that go beyond the Dalet Amot of Halakha, beyond the four cubits of Halakha, in this discussion. Again, if you read Rabbi Sperber's article, especially the beginning of it, and certain parts of Rabbi Shapiro's article, there's a frustration there. There's a frustration about Halakha. There's a frustration about the ossification of Halakha. And this was a pet peeve with Rabbi Sperber before this occurred. He wrote in Tradition in 2002 an article called Paralysis in Contemporary Halakha. Right, this is before this controversy. And you find this in many other people as well, including in our own Beit Midrash. Some of our writings, I think, express such a frustration. Also, and you'll even find someone as mainstream as Rav Lichtenstein. I don't know if there's a page numbering in what I gave you, but in the version here in Leaves of Faith, Volume 1, it's on page 175, where he speaks about poskim, especially in the modern area, are often reluctant to invoke broad axiological heterim when they can construct more narrowly based decisions, etc., etc. He's not happy with that, right? So this idea of ossification... Sorry?
It's the bottom of page 9.
Bottom of page 9, thank you. This idea that halakha somehow seems to be less flexible is a little bit at the bottom of this argument, in the sense that people like Rabbi Sperber and like Rabbi Shapiro and many others. I don't know if you saw the article that I sent you today. There was another article that also appeared in the ADA Journal several years back by Mark Shapiro. It's not really his article. I mean, he has a few comments, essentially a letter from the Sri De H responding to a critique of his student, Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz, in which he also expresses frustration that the halakha seems to be stagnant. He says this in defense of Rabbi Berkovitz. He says it also that's motivating Yeshaya Leibovitz and perhaps some of his lesser known writings. It's not really what he's known primarily for in our times, at least in his religious writings. But in any case, this is something that's echoed by many, many people. Halakha is not responding to change in the same way it has historically. Now, the truth is, I think that really can be unpacked in two different ways. As it can be pshuto kamashmao, that rabbis are more conservative. Rabbi Sperber, in the article that also appears on the syllabus, not on Movements Aliyot, the friendly posek, which is very good to read, at least the first part. We'll send it to you before next class. gives you some reasons why that may be. Right, that there's more communication, meaning that it's easier to get into trouble. If you're a rabbi and you say something liberal, you have more people who are going to get on your back, and we can attest to that in our institution as well. And other reasons as well. There are many other reasons as well. For this, there's a hitkatnut. I mean, the Sridesh of Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg says, I sympathize with the problem, but we're so small. How can we, being of such little stature, say things that are daring whatsoever? In any case, that's one aspect of the problem. But another way to unpack it, and maybe both aspects are true, is that perhaps we... the Tzibur, who somehow is a foot in both worlds, which is probably ultimately the vast majority of the Orthodox world, not only the modern Orthodox world, but the vast majority of the Haredi world as well, expect more change in the sense that the world is changing faster today in many more ways. Just on a purely clinical level, and going back to the world of science, there's so much more scientific information that is coming out, that one would expect more of a response. In other words, if we were simply to say that halakha, if there's 10 new items, that halakha will respond to 2 items, So it would one would think that if there's 100 new items, then halacha would respond to 20. So I'm not sure, is it that we're more conservative, and instead of responding 2 to 10, we're responding 1 to 10? Or is it that we're responding the same ratio of 20 to 100, but now, instead of having 8 items that are not responded to, we have 80 items that are not responded to? And again, both of these issues, in other words, it's just to make a graphic, it could be that we're responding to 10 out of 100 as opposed to 2 out of 10, wherein both problems are brought to bear. In any case, and on some level, you know, I've heard people say, you guys are completely off. You're just simply not aware that there is change, and there's no more or less change in halakha than there's been in the past. Such a statement has been made also. Again, it's hard for me to be objective because it's something that I feel to be true on a very deep level, but certainly there are other opinions to this. But you should know that such an idea is out there. It's out there not just in the Beit Midrash, among many other intelligent people who care about the halachic process feel that it's being stultified. So that's a very important thing that you should look carefully at if you get a chance to look at all, at least some of these tshuvot, hopefully all of these articles that we sent you at the beginning of the week. Now another issue, so we're not going to get to the Rabbi Lichtenstein article today, but let's at least spend the last 5 to 10 minutes, 5 if I don't cheat, 10 if I do, but I think it's going to be 10, on the other issues that were brought out by this discussion of women's aliyot. I'm going to read you again from what Rabbi Gideon Rothstein wrote in response to these articles allowing for women's aliyot. Listen to what he says. He's first responding to Rabbi Sperber. He says, broad brush arguments of human dignity, kavod abriyot, which was the main part of the argument that Rabbi Cardoza said, broad brush arguments of human dignity could militate in favor of removing the mechitza from synagogues, counting women for a minyan, allowing Jews to drive on Shabbat, or to be driven by a non-Jew, or to be able to reach a synagogue, as long as we could find a way to define the prohibition in each case as rabbinic ones. Okay, so the starting point is that Rabbi Sperber picks a very dangerous avenue of kavod abriyot, saying that kavod abriyot basically can trump any rabbinic prohibitions. It says Rabbi Rothstein that there are many other rabbinic prohibitions that you could see as problematic, that we have a need, right? As we said before, we have a need, some sort of legitimate need to revise, and one could use his argumentation in all these cases as well. He says Rabbi Sperber is obviously not arguing for any of these things, but his less than careful resolution of a conflict between two halachic values is, listen carefully, is of a type that has been used to much more damaging effect by those clearly outside the halachic process. Another word for conservative, right? Reformed don't care about the halachic process, conservative do. From my perspective, continues later, the problems I've pointed out, and it goes back to Rabbi Shapiro's article, and Rabbi Shapiro's analysis mean not only that he's wrong, but that his views and those who act upon them stand outside the orthodox halakha. So says Rabbi Rothstein. What he's saying is that the arguments stand outside of legitimate halachic discussion. I asked him once, I didn't get an answer, probably for no reason they didn't have time. It was an email discussion, and I asked him several things. I asked him why he felt that way. I didn't get a response to that question, what made it outside the pale. But I think the issue of what creates legitimate halachic discussion is an important issue. I think that the problem is going to boil down much more to who is saying something than what they say. I remember when I was at Yeshiva University, one of the rabbis who's no longer alive presented us a tshuva of a Rabbi Klein from the JTS about cheese, about Ren and cheese. And my Havruta was still is a Kanai, is very, very, why is it Kanai? Zealous, right? So he went crazy. He, in class, out of class, he was very upset that this rabbi, our Magid Shir, gave us to look at this conservative tshuva. Question comes up, what precisely makes a conservative tshuva? And what creates the psul in a conservative tshuva, or the lack of psul of an orthodox tshuva? As what creates, why is this tshuva of Rabbi Shapiro outside the realms of halachic discussion? And I don't see, one second, I didn't see anything, maybe I'm not as knowledgeable as Rabbi Rothstein, but I didn't see anything that I could identify as bringing it outside the realm of orthodox halachic discussion. Now, I'm not saying that these rabbis are right, but that doesn't take them outside of the pale of discussion. I would go further, that even going back to Rabbi Klein's tshuva or any conservative tshuva, right, if the facts are correct, then we can use that same tshuva and be mekadesh it, and we can adopt it. We can say that he has all the right arguments, and therefore we come to the same conclusion. There's no reason in my mind not to study a conservative tshuva if it's on the level. Now, there are two caveats I would make. Number one, it has to be on the level. Number two, it cannot be contaminated by positions that are anathema to normative halachan theology. Such to the most obvious in the conservative movement being the right of the rabbinic assembly or any other court nowadays simply to repeal earlier rabbinic enactments. If you remember going back to our previous discussion, we said that if a rabbinic court established halacha today, we can't go straight on and say we're going to repeal it. In the conservative movement, they said we can't. Okay, so if Rabbi Klein or any other conservative posek were to say the reason something's permissible is because we're rescinding that law, that's simply not something that we're going to buy into. Theologically, if it has to do, and this is much more rare because it has very little halakhic application, but if somehow Torah not being from Shemayim, not being divinely given, were to play into the halakhic process of the conservative posek, that would also create a problem. But I think the real issue is not whether a discussion is a, quote, conservative discussion or an orthodox discussion. By the way, that's one of the standard weak arguments that's given to anybody who wants to innovate something, is to say that, well, that's what the conservatives are saying. The answer to that is, so what? You know, if the conservatives are right, let it be. If the conservatives are wrong, so what difference does it make that the conservatives are saying it? Let's analyze the statement on its own merits, not simply where it comes from. It's like a classical Rambam and then the introduction to the Perush and the Shemoneh Prokim. I think it makes a lot of sense. But I think that the more fundamental issue, and this is going to be much more critical, because ultimately the conservative world has very little to offer us in terms of their halakhic analysis. Simply, most of them are clearly lightweight. There's very little substantive discussion that we really need to pay attention to. So it's not really the thing. And I think calling Orthodox rabbis, especially someone in the stature of Rabbi Sperber, as being outside the pale of halakha involves a certain amount of chutzpah, which I think is untenable. There's discussion. Well, I think even that's a bit of chutzpah, personal.
So Robert Hepkin actually writes that he gives all the good reasons, all the ends. He says he's outside the thing.
No, he says that people who are going to do it, he says that the practice, practice, but the tshuva he likes, he has no problems with.
He's only saying, if you do it,
you're outside. Yeah, which is a different discussion. But we're going to discuss this more next time. I'll give you a chance. But let me just finish the thought. The discussion that I really want to focus on is not what makes an Orthodox posek or psak, but what makes an influential or on a lower level accepted broadly, societally, psak or posek? Or to put the question differently, when people like Rabbi Mendel Shapiro, who I don't think many of us have heard of, who's ultimately a lawyer in the same way as Dov Frimmer is a lawyer, Aryeh Frimmer is a scientist, and Yehuda Levy is a scientist, when these people come out with position papers or articles, even if their arguments are convincing, does this impact on normative halakha? And if it doesn't, right, are there any other options we have with the frustration that many of us, including these writers and rabbis, feel to express these feelings and these concerns out in a way that we can impact on historical psak to bring it back to where we feel it should be? And perhaps we should broaden the discussion whether these feelings of ours are acceptable, legitimate to begin with, because certainly some people would say that they are not. Binyamin, you want to say something?
So, I sense that even what you were saying, conservative orthodox issue, and I'm missing that distinction because many of the situations that I've seen, ranging from topics like Tzad Mechitza and Shul, say keeping a Zion Nikians, driving to Shul and Shabbat, all of these Shuvot are using essentially the exact same parameters that you were describing last week and this week about the Gzera not applying about all these things.
Right.
They're almost like I was reading these Shuvot and it reminded me of so many of the conservative Shuvot. What is the...
Okay, so and this is what Rabbi Rothstein says to put a psul on the tshuvot of women's aliyah. He's saying it reminds me of the conservative tshuvot, but the other side is that nonetheless, as you're pointing out, we see it throughout the history of halakha. So I think the bottom line is going to be again, who's saying it? In other words, whether and we're going to speak about this much more next week. What creates halachic stature such that Klal Yisrael, meaning Klal Yisrael that are loyal to halacha, ascribe to a position as not so much legitimate as much as accepted? That's really going to be the issue. And in that, I think the issue is not going to be necessarily whether a person is conservative or orthodox. So I think that has some bearing. But rather, what's the makeup of that person? I think it has less to do with scholarship than Yirat Shamayim. And we're going to discuss that very tricky issue, which is brought in some of the Tshuvot. Guys,